To begin with, could you describe this work?
Yes, of course. What I've done is to change a glass of water into a full-grown oak tree without altering the accidents of the glass of water.
The accidents?
Yes, the color, feel, weight, size.
Do you mean that the glass of water is a symbol of an oak tree?
No, it's not a symbol. I've changed the physical substance of the glass of water into that of an oak tree.
It looks like a glass of water.
Of course it does. I didn't change its appearance, but it's not a glass of water, it's an oak tree.
Can you prove what you claim to have done?
Well, yes and no. I claim to have maintained the physical form of the glass of water, and as you can see, I have. However, as one normally looks for evidence of physical change in terms of altered form, no such proof exists.
Haven't you simply called this glass of water an oak tree?
Absolutely not. It is not a glass of water anymore. I have changed its actual substance. It would no longer be accurate to call it a glass of water. One could call it anything one wished, but that would not alter the fact that it is an oak tree.
Isn't this just a case of the emperor's new clothes?
No. With the emperor's new clothes, people claimed to see something which wasn't there because they felt they should. I would be very surprised if anyone told me they saw an oak tree.
Was it difficult to effect the change?
No effort at all. But it took me years of work before I realized I could do it.
When precisely did the glass of water become an oak tree?
When I put water in the glass.
Does this happen every time you fill a glass with water?
No, of course not. Only when I intend to change it into an oak tree.
Then intention causes the change.
I would say it precipitates the change.
Then you don't know how you do it.
It contradicts what I feel I know about cause and effect.
It seems to me you're claiming to have worked a miracle. Isn't that the case?
I'm flattered that you think so.
But aren't you the only person who can do something like this?
How could I know?
Could you teach others to do it?
No, it's not something one can teach.
Do you consider that changing the glass of water into an oak tree constitutes an artwork?
Yes.
What precisely is the artwork? The glass of water?
There is no glass of water anymore.
The process of change?
There is no process involved in the change.
The oak tree?
Yes, the oak tree.
But the oak tree only exists in the mind.
No, the actual oak tree is physically present in the form of the glass of water. As the glass of water was a particular glass of water, the oak tree is also particular. To conceive the category oak tree or to picture a particular oak tree is not to understand and experience what appears to be a glass of water as an oak tree. Just as it is imperceivable, it is also inconceivable.
Did the particular oak tree exist somewhere else before it took the form of the glass of water?
No, this particular oak tree did not exist previously. I should also point out that it does not and will not ever have any other form but that of a glass of water.
How long will it continue to be an oak tree?
Until I change it.
Hello, this is Chris Evans. I'm the Secretary of the Brain Research Association, and I've also supplied this extract from my interview with Noam Chomsky, which I did at MIT last year. The idea of doing these tapes came to me when I myself was interviewed about my own work, and I felt that it would be really interesting if one could have cassette interviews or discussions done by scientists for scientists. Well, thanks very much. I hope you'll find this interesting. Professor Chomsky, many people assume that there are three, as you put it actually, I think, three models for the description of language: a finite state grammar, what you call a phrase structure grammar, and your rather dramatic development, the transformational grammar. And these are the kind of things which lots of people find rather difficult to get clear in their minds. Could you say something about the three types of grammar, how they work, as it were, where they interact, and so on and so forth?
Yes, I will. We first have to recognize that this is a discussion that has to do with intellectual issues that were alive in the 1950s. By now, there are different alternatives that are under live consideration. Finite state grammar is the kind of system that would result from the most sophisticated psychological models of perception and production that one can imagine on the basis of the concepts of habit or habit structure or stimulus and response and so on. The idea is that the system, let's say the mind, has a finite set of possible configurations, which is certainly true, that it accepts linguistic material one symbol at a time, which again is true, and as it accepts a particular linguistic symbol, as a sentence is produced, let's say the first symbol and the second symbol and so on, are accepted by this system, and each time that the system is activated by a new symbol which appears, and it moves into a new state, and finally it ends up in some terminal state, designated terminal state, then it has accepted the sequence as a sentence, and let's say has understood it or perceived it. And there's no doubt that one ought to be able to describe any perceptual model in these terms for a finite device. The question, however, was whether the actual knowledge of language that the mind possesses is entirely representable in terms of such a device. And while there was a belief that that was true in the 1950s, it can be demonstrated that that is not true, and there's certainly no paradox or problem in that. So I think that finite state models have virtually lost their interest as models for grammar, and in fact I know of no one who studies them.
You're basically a linguist, philosopher and mathematician as well. I suppose one needs to be those three things, really, or at least one needs to be a mathematician and a philosopher to be a good linguist, perhaps. And yet you've had some very productive work with psychologists, in particular George Miller. How did you first come to work with a psychologist at a time when linguists and psychologists were considered to be absolutely poles apart?
Well, I think George Miller and I found that our thoughts were moving along more or less parallel tracks in the mid-1950s. As I recall, we must have begun talking seriously together and then working together by about 1956 or so. And Miller had done very productive work on cognitive psychology, developing information theoretic models, and had begun to see their basic inadequacy, I believe, and we were jointly interested in the question of the relationships among the various kinds of models that we were discussing earlier, and the reasons for and the basis for the inadequacy of finite state models, the most abstract models that one could dream of achieving within the framework of even cognitive psychology, let alone behavioral psychology, as then understood. And we then went on to investigate jointly both the mathematical properties of some of these more complicated systems and also the possible implications for psycholinguistics, a field of which he is very much the grand master, the implications from the hypothesis that these more abstract and complex models play a fundamental and central role in knowledge of language and hence in performance.
Several things that you were saying must have seemed absolutely anathema to the psychologists of the 40s and the 50s. In first, I think the notion of there being a universal grammar, which is one of your important hypotheses, a grammar that's constant for every type of human being. And secondly, the idea that the basis of this grammar must somehow be inherited and passed over. Now, in many ways, these ideas perhaps don't seem quite so shocking now in the 70s as they did then. But I think it's worth trying to find out exactly what you are saying about the carryover of, first of all, the universal grammar. Do you still feel that such a grammar is constant and present in all human beings?
Well, I think there can be no doubt among rational people that there is a very rich and complicated innate structure that permits us to acquire these highly articulated, very specific, extremely rich systems of knowledge, such as knowledge of language, on the basis of the highly degenerate information that's presented to us as language learners or learners of anything else for that matter. The only question is, what is the nature of this innate system? And here I think one can very roughly distinguish two major tendencies to major beliefs, which have a long tradition of controversy and conflict. One approach, I'll call it empiricist because I think it does express the leading idea of traditional empiricism, is that what is innate to the mind is a system of processes and procedures and analytic mechanisms, a kind of data processing procedure by which the data of sense, which is given a preliminary analysis in terms of innate structures of perception, is then further organized. So, for example, when Hume says that that part of our knowledge which comes to us from the original hand of nature is simply the animal instinct of induction, and that everything else is simply matter-forming associations, he's describing what we might think of as a kind of primitive data processing procedure, speaking of innate knowledge, incidentally, I think quite properly. That is a clear expression of one general approach towards the problem of acquisition of knowledge. We have data of sense. We have a preliminary processing system which analyzes it into properties and so on. And then we have certain procedures like the procedure of forming associations or of carrying out induction or of developing habit structures of some sort or of carrying out constituent analysis, say. That's what I meant by saying that Harris's approach was the most sophisticated empiricist approach that existed. And our knowledge is simply the result of the application of these innate data processing procedures to the presented data of sense. That's one approach. Another approach, which seems to me to express the leading ideas of traditional rationalism, and I'll here call it a rationalist approach, is to say that the structure of our system of knowledge is what is predetermined. It's the form of the knowledge that's predetermined. We have a schematism, which determines the kinds of knowledge and the arrangement of principles and concepts that can be acquired on the basis of experience. And this approach pays little attention to, and in fact gives little interest in, such procedures as may exist to move from the data to the knowledge. If we think of the problem of learning as having three elements, namely input, operation, and output, the system has a certain input of experience, it carries out a certain operation, and it has a certain output as a result. That's learning in a most general sense. The empiricist approach, it takes the position that it's the procedure, it's the operation that is innate and is of fundamental importance, and the output is anything that that procedure determines when it is applied to data. So if you think of learning as a sort of a function mapping input into output, it's the function that's of interest to the empiricist. Now, the rationalist, on the other hand, is saying the function isn't of much interest, the operation. Rather, it's the output that is of interest, and the output is very sharply constrained. It must be of a certain type. So a rationalist theory of perception would say that we perceive the data of sense in terms of schematisms which are determined by, let's say, the geometrical notions of regular figure, because the mind produces the regular triangle innately, and we see actual triangles as distorted variants of regular triangles because the mind simply deals with those regular geometrical figures. An empiricist might try to approach the same material by saying that we somehow form the notion of regular geometrical figure by association or induction or whatever. Here is a clear case where I think the rationalist approach, which was developed in the 17th century, in fact, is almost certainly correct if developed in a modern form. Well, applying these perhaps overly sharp differentiations to the case of language, there is an approach which is very well represented by the best work, the most sophisticated work in structural linguistics, which sought to express and develop precisely procedures of analysis which would yield grammatical structures, knowledge of language, if you like, by application to a corpus of data. That's one approach. The rationalist approach, on the other hand, says the kinds of language that are accessible to the mind are a very narrowly restricted class. And the task that the child has is to discover which of the humanly accessible languages is the one to which he is being exposed. On the empiricist grounds, what the child would be asking is this. He would say, well, I have this data of sense. Now, what kind of associations can I form, and what kind of habits can I construct, and so on and so forth, not consciously, of course. On the rationalist approach, the child is more or less asking, I have this data of sense. Which of the possible languages is this a specimen of? Is it a specimen of Japanese? No, because it doesn't fit the principles of Japanese. Is it a specimen of English? Well, maybe. Okay, let's assume that it is. If it is, I know English. And if that hypothesis is confirmed, he then uses the knowledge of English, which now knowledge of English under this approach may not be related to the data of English by any kind of procedure of analysis at all. In fact, if our original schematism, our universal grammar, is narrow and restricted enough, then very small amounts of data may be sufficient to select among the several grammars which are potentially available for this subject matter and to tell us, yes, I'm hearing English, so therefore I know that I can use English from now on. Well, I don't mean any of this literally, of course. This is a way of trying to separate as sharply as possible two very different approaches, two very different concepts, and as I guess these remarks indicate, I believe that the rationalist approach is correct, that the process of learning languages is a process which we can explain as follows. The mind innately has a universal grammar, a very narrow restriction that permits certain systems and excludes other systems which would be equally useful for communication but just don't happen to fit the structure of the mind. And the task of learning is to discover which of the possible systems is the one to which the child is being exposed. It is the task of taking this universal schematism, this framework, and putting a little meat on the bones, that is, finding out how it is articulated specifically in this particular case, filling in details that are left empty and open in the schematism. But the result is largely predetermined by the innate structure of the mind. That's this thesis. And as you say, that is, was, maybe perhaps still is, anathema to psychologists, though not, I should think, to at least physiological psychologists who take for granted something rather similar in their own work all the time. I mean, it shouldn't be any surprise to, let's say, a physiological psychologist that that our concepts of visual space, let's say, are based on highly articulated, very specific schematisms that are determined by the structure of the brain, by the structure of the visual cortex. I think it would be a rare physiological psychologist these days who would believe that our interpretation of visual space is developed by long procedures of association and conditioning. In fact, what he would expect to find and what we do find is very specific structures that are put into operation on the occasion of experience, but that have the character that they do because that's the way our brain is. I mean, if we were a different organism, we'd do it differently. And I don't see any reason to suppose that the case of language, or for that matter, any other cognitive system is any different. In fact, it's striking that the traditional, I think dogma is the right word, the traditional dogma of psychology, that the mind is an unstructured system, first of all, if that dogma is true, it would mean that the mind is unique among biological systems. In any place where we know anything about some biological system, we find that it doesn't operate that way. Rather, it has its very specific predetermined structure, which it develops, of course, through interaction with the environment, but a great deal of which, in fact, a fundamental part of which, is predetermined by the nature of that system. And there is, as far as I can see, no reason to expect in advance that that the mind, the human mind, is in any way different than the known types of biological systems. Nor do we find that it is. Where we begin to understand anything, we find that it does have unique and specific properties. In the areas where we understand nothing, of course, the psychologist is still free to hold on to his dogma. But I suspect that, I think it's a fair prediction, that the domain of this dogma will be gradually restricted as more and more is learned about the nature of cognitive systems and maybe ultimately about the physiological structures in which they're based.
Mover, change your luck for Date Monday the 17th, December 1973. Hanover Grand, Hanover Street, London, West 1. Time 8 p.m. Weather overcast. Temperature outside 50, inside 68. London atmosphere tense. Imminent power reductions, more bombings. 5 Mackenzie freezers, 2 horizontal, 3 vertical. 128 cubic capacity. 2 short arm oak chrome pose poles with chrome highlighters, 6 watts. 4 3-meter long chrome pose poles plus attachments. 8 personal posture provokers with individual settings. 25 chrome and steel Ryberg trouser clips. 2 3 12-inch 110 Veriflex mirrors. No published measurements. 5 Morphy Richards steam irons, set for cotton. 1 industrial pack Swiss hair stabilizer. 1 industrial can Permacrease full fixative, import. 2 liters Carba tetrachloride. Personal pose assistants: Rob Cawthorpe, height 5'8", weight 120 pounds, medium pose specialist. Ian Davis, height 6'3", weight 180 pounds, known arm expert. Richard Butler, height 5'8½", weight 124 pounds, ex-Lou Reed impersonator. Brano Radovic, height 5'7", weight 170 pounds, speciality strength moves. Timothy Mapston, height 5'8", weight 120 pounds, stance mold. Stylisticians: Vicky, 3/4 length black, off-the-shoulder crepe de chine cocktail dress. Mandy, 3/4 length black sequin two-piece. Terry, black satin halter neck full-length evening dress. Isla, black high-necked 3/4 length cocktail dress. Caroline, black low-cut full-skirted crepe evening dress. Nice Style, the world's first pose man, seated left to right by velvet-covered 12-foot-long table, 1 foot 2 inches from the floor. 5 glasses, 5 stiff Manhattans, 3 low-lipped ashtrays, cigarettes unmarked. Bruce McLean, ill-fitting, well-designed white tuxedo suit, modelled on Serge Gainsborough, with too much cuff, too much collar, tie too loose and too long, crutch too baggy, trousers too black, too long and too short. New York black brogues, tied to the left. Lace ends never more than 1¼ inches from knot. Heels especially worn down by tailors of Bond Street, within 1/8 of base. Scuffing on right left side of shoe by Millers of Paris. Scuffing on left side of right shoe by Ryan O'Neill, superstar. Hair worn straight back from crown. Paul Richards, a white tuxedo with a change of 8 jackets. First jacket, loose cut, dirt proof, with a low level crease rating. Second jacket, left sleeve, lower elbow crease clamp, high crease rating. Third jacket, lounge Italian, thin, tight, with a smooth vinyl lining for a fast change, time worn 3 seconds. Medium to good crease rating. Fourth jacket, cigar stained, ivory trimmed. Steel stiffened lapels held by wires connected to crease clamps, concealed in left pocket. Fifth jacket, absolutely no visible creases. Sixth jacket, worn wet, no buttons, fixed fold on left side. Seventh jacket, completely rigid. Eighth jacket, unpressed, apart from corner fold at bottom of right side. Hair worn to the left. Gary Chitty, white tuxedo jacket, sleeve short, shirt sleeve cuffs, heavily starched. Arrogant 3 inches shown. Cufflinks, Bond Street, solid gold, 1 inch square, designed by Piers Cook. Hair mean short on top, sides and back flawless, gesturing extravagant, a tendency to limber arms during a tense moment. Ron Carr, outrageous bow tie styled to a depth of 3¼ inches by Paul Lee, tuxedo trousers, long crease, sharp enough to slice a loaf of bread, tuxedo jacket hung loose, posture casual, resentful of too much attention. Pose poles and mirrors swept aside by graceful yet aggressive arm gestures. Robin Fletcher, lean 6'1", dazzling white tuxedo, noted percussion cuff pose, favoring 28 millimeters of shirt for long distance, 23 millimeters for close-up postures. right cuff mirror plated to enhance stance. Works with a 5-foot vertical Mackenzie freezer. Seen seated tonight on the far right. Smokes Gold Flake. Drinks Dimple and Malvern. No ice. Recorded on a Steinbeck at 30 inches per second. Half-track stereo double duplicated in mono. Microphones in use were two Philips K7795-301/A/772063.
I welcome you all here this evening. My name is Sean O'Connor. I am to introduce Nystyle and hopefully to relay your questions and Nystyle's answers back to you. But first, an example of their work. In fact, the pose that took them to the top. Ladies and gentlemen, with sideboard freeze, Nystyle!